This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time. In one way or another, we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Lawrence Jackson, author of the nonfiction book Shelter.
As a child, I would always ask my dad, "My God, how could you accept segregation or discrimination? You know, what's wrong with you? Why didn't you rise up?"
We'll be back with Lawrence Jackson after these essential words. First, I want to say to you, thank you for listening. First Draft is now in its 9th year of production. 9 years. That's over 3,200 days I've been hustling to create this show. Hustling to get up at 5 a.m. to do interviews, hustling at midnight to edit a show in time for it to go live on a Monday. It takes hustle to do this show. And that's why I'm asking you to please support First Draft, a dialogue on writing on Patreon. You can find out more at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. This show wouldn't be here without others like you who converted from fans to supporters. Plus, you can feel good about supporting conversations like the one you're about to hear. And with your donation, you are saying yes to continuing this space for writers and readers and those curious about the artistic process. So let's be honest, there is so much free content out there, and I know I'm competing with it. And what you're listening to is free, but it is not without expense and hard costs and labor to make. And don't get me wrong, producing these interviews is a labor of love. But all told, from scheduling, preparation, reading time, interviewing, editing, and finalizing each episode, we're talking about a minimum of 15 hours each episode. Other expenses are also involved: equipment, subscriptions to interview platforms, editing software, hosting services for the sound, and a website for the archive. I know you may not be in front of a computer right now, so why not write a note on your hand or set the alarm on your phone to remind you to donate to First Draft when you get home? Please beat the odds of having to listen to this 7 times before you join the First Draft community. Go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. This takes hardcore commitment on my side, so I'm asking you if you appreciate this show. I'd love to feel your love. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, and you can donate on a monthly or annual basis. In gratitude for your support, my patrons receive extra benefits, including cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, ad-free, pitch-free episodes, writing tips from my guests, and more. Once you become a patron, you never have to hear me say this pitch again, and there are no ads in the beginning of the show. So whatever you can afford is welcome. Please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters to donate today. Please stay tuned. At the end of the show, I'll offer recommendations on an episode in the archive that is similar to the one you're about to hear. And please rate the show on iTunes and tell everyone you know to subscribe. And thank you for your support and for being with me here today, right now, in this moment. I'm really appreciative. And on to the show. My guest today is nonfiction writer Lawrence Jackson. He is a biographer and critic whose work has appeared in Harper's Magazine, N Plus One, and Best American Essays. He teaches English and history at Johns Hopkins and founded the Billie Holiday Project for Liberation Arts. His book Shelter is a series of essays Lawrence Jackson wrote about moving back to Baltimore, the city he grew up in after a divorce in 2016. He writes about his complicated relationship with his neighborhood, the city, and its history. His new neighborhood, Homeland, is largely white and built on racial covenants. His essays focus on domesticity, inheritance, and Lawrence's experiences and insights into Black American life. We began the discussion with me sharing with Lawrence Jackson some themes I saw in his book and his response about what brought him to the page. These are really meditations on the hidden history that we can't see, but that not only built Baltimore, but built our country based on slavery and racism and injustice. And you look at things like the foundation of your house, the architect, the neighborhood, the names of things, the emblems of things, the who built the foundations. You look at church, you look at your family life, you look at your yard work. But it's all sort of through this lens of really looking at what is the history, what do we need to confront about race, and, you know, what brought you to this moment?
You know, I suppose if you looked at the idea of irony, or tried to think about what people mean when they say, "Oh, you know, I found out about that and I was shocked," and you would, I think that you would learn that those exclamations and that those literary tropes had reached a point of exhaustion when you tried to apply them to the Black experience. And here's what I mean. Like, two of the fascinating ironies for me that help, I think, the reader to sort of get at the experience that I wanted to bring out onto the page. The place that I went to high school in, it's the very near suburb, just over the city line in Baltimore. And it was a high school that had been located in the city until the 1930s, when it, you know, sort of went into a larger campus in Baltimore County. And all of this movement of any family or group of people in a city like Baltimore, I mean, it is always reflecting upon some racial dynamic, because Baltimore had been the place of the largest number of freed people in urban America in the antebellum era. So the thing that's always struck me about the high school that I attended was that, for whatever reason, the structure of the buildings always seemed, you know, I don't know, glorious to me. Or there was something about the Gothic stone that really spoke to my 13, 14-year-old self. And the ideal that I had about American national belonging, citizenship, upward mobility, I mean, it really did sort of capture a bunch of those things. I had gone to for 10 years, I had gone to an elementary and middle school that was in the classic post-World War II brick box style, okay? And so then I went to Loyola High School in Baltimore for high school. The person who designed the main academic building on my high school campus also designed the house that I'm living in today. And so it's a similar experience. When I was driving down the street, this would be, you know, like, this is 30 years later. I'm in my late 40s when we moved, returned to Baltimore. We were living in Atlanta, moved back to Baltimore. And I'm sort of struck by a particular design, a particular pattern of stone. It means something to me that's intangible about, you know, having achieved a particular kind of social class status. Martin Luther King used to talk about being integrated with power. It for whatever reason, you know, sort of captured some of those romantic and sentimental ideals, which is why in the book I have all of these epigraphs, you know, sort of from like Sir Walter Scott and John Bunyan and Venerable Bede. And, you know, I'm interested in like the place where the romanticism and Protestantism, you know, sort of come together or have their, you know, sort of moment of genesis. So that would be one. And then another one would be that I'm in church. Another one of these ironies that I say, I mean, it exceeds what I think, you know, we might find useful with the term irony. I'm in church one morning and with my son and my mom, and, you know, we sort of have a community where we, you know, go to church and we sit in the same pew. And the woman in front of me turns around, and I don't even know how she knew precisely where I lived. And she says, "Oh, my father worked in your house." And she, you know, calls the name of the original owner. And this person I've known all my life, you know, imparts this detail that is absolutely the other history, the underside of history, the component that is key in any full definition of reality, especially in a place like the United States, which is always going back and forth between being a total slave society or a society with slaves or a democratic society or a partially democratic society. And I'm reminded that even at this moment in my own life of relative economic prosperity, and I emphasize relativity here, but that I'm still always a person who carries and inherits and embodies a legacy that is its antithesis. And I know it's easy to be confused on this point, but I am also a person who thinks that the work that Mr. Woods did in my house was completely honorable. I mean, he was a college graduate. He was a full-time postal worker. And I presume that this was also like, you know, sort of his supplementary side job. But I would think of him as an absolutely honorable figure. I mean, very much not an Uncle Tom or a one-dimensional servant or something like that. But I find it, you know, I can't say that I'm shocked to learn that or that it surprises me. Rather, you know, I've got to generate some kind of other term to define what is this particular sort of American experience. Many people from my generation, you know, were like profoundly influenced by the autobiography of Malcolm X. Or maybe I should say in the same way that someone like Spike Lee is influenced by that narrative collaboration between Alex Haley and Malcolm X. And Malcolm X goes to the African continent in the middle of 1964 for several months. And he says that he's greeted when he gets to Nigeria with the term Omowale. And Omowale is, Yoruba word for a son who has returned, but it winds up being a concept that's also quite significant for us who are coming out of urban America and going back to it, or I suppose trying to make fruitful connections back to it. I have a very dear colleague in the city, a writer named D. Watkins, and he captures another kind of audience, I think, than the one that I get to. But he says, that the goal is not to make it out of the ghetto. The goal is to make it better. Or he doesn't use ghetto in that phrasing, but it's not make it out, but make it better. And it's that kind of thing. The person who has returned or who has come back, that becomes the occasion for the essays. I mean, you know, I had this remarkable opportunity to come and teach at Johns Hopkins, and I could make a kind of an investment or a contribution in the city that I had grown up in. I mean, one of the things that I'm most proud of is the participation that I get to have in the church that I grew up in. I mean, I received a scholarship to go to college from my church. The scholarship was named after really probably the most consequential minister from the church who took the Black Episcopalians really from the immediate after effects of the Civil War and then through the early 20th century. And it was a remarkable figure named George F. Bragg. It's the same church that actually also produces the very first Black bishop of the entire Episcopal Church, Michael Curry, of course, who married, the Prince of Windsor and Meghan Markle. I don't know what the titles are, but anyway, Meghan and Harry, and, you know, who's presiding at the funeral of George Herbert Walker Bush. So the book is trying to, you know, or using the occasion of my return, I think, to pull some of these, you know, sort of historical and contemporary trends and struggles, places of crisis and responsibility that we all share in common, and to infuse them with a deep historical sense, such as I am able. I was joking with the audience the other day, or not so much joking, but I was saying, you know, like I teach in a history department and an English department today,
But I'm a dilettante historian. I don't have any professional credentials to lay claim to the mantle of the historian. Mm-hmm.
So with all this as your intention to write this, what was your experience of actually writing it? Meaning, like, what did you discover? What did it do for your craft of writing? And what did it do for your relationship with the history and present of where you live?
The thing maybe that I noticed with this project that might be slightly different from other things that I've done was that I did become more comfortable with the idea that the audience might, that the reader might make a connection with, I suppose, something that was, you know, could be understood as fairly fragmented, or that was joined in this this concept of, you know, sort of following along with the festival season from the Christian church, that it would go Advent and Christmas and Lent and, you know, Easter and Pentecost and, you know, sort of finally arrive to its conclusion, which is like ordinary time. And, you know, I wanted in that way to also try to make it a somewhat optimistic rendering, possibly a little bit more optimistic than I might be in day-to-day life or in my own internal reflection. So, you know, the chapters do, I looked closely a couple of days ago, and the chapters, they all do sort of conclude with, you know, like a chance for a brighter future. But they are, you know, trying to work through the difficulty. And also this thing about the anti-heroism. Somebody asked me at a reading a couple of days ago, well, you know, doesn't this sort of serve as a point of entree for politics? Or, you know, aren't some of these the qualities that we would you know, hope to have in a particular kind of politician? But I mean, that is also something that I was thinking about, you know, trying to trod mildly against, which is, you know, the beatification and the hagiography of the you know, the devotions to the saints, the saint making process that always reduces the world of human complexity. And I think with, in some ways, maybe I had in the back of my mind that with this essay format, you know, you would always know that there was not going to be, you know, sort of the tidy dressing up of, you know, either myself as the narrator or one of the other figures that makes their way into the account. You asked what the how has it impacted or changed, or, you know, anything with my place in the neighborhood. And I would say I once looked up, you know, sort of systematically all of the people on my street, and it's, you know, very much an upper middle class group. I mean, including the heads of investment firms and judges and prominent physicians and attorneys and that sort of thing, some government officials or bureau chiefs. And I think that part of what I am also trying to work with in this account is, you know, what is really required to sort of get this group to pay attention to the circumstance of their own day-to-day lives. And I don't know that you know, will be necessarily effective or particularly impactful. That is, for me, another, you know, wrestling match, I guess I would say. The Episcopalian church that I belong to, you know, is sometimes thought of as like, I mean, you know, it's not so distant from the Catholic Church, and it's very formal religious or worship ceremonies and rituals sometimes can be thought of as like a high church that suppresses emotion and suppresses really the full participation of the congregation. But nonetheless, you know, I'm also trying to make an argument that part of what is going to help us through the backdrop enemy in this work is the neoliberal economic arrangements and practices, but that part of what will help us achieve, you know, sort of greater human fulfillment and democratic participation, but then also democratic economic arrangements, is going to come from the camp of reason, and is going to come from with a healthy contribution from people who are in a strong position of leadership. But it does have something to do with like involving them in a new or another kind of conversation with the majority of us. I mean, I don't know, I think of myself as us. And so I wanted it to be useful or at least accessible on multiple sides of the class, education, race divide. But I will have to say, you know, Mitzi, it does remain to be seen, you know, like how it will be perceived.
One of the things you wrote in there, I think this is verbatim, was that you wondered if your desire to live in Homeland, which is this very nice neighborhood, was connected to a seeming fondness for ancient white power. Is that a question you answered during the writing, or does it still exist for you?
Yeah, so it's a even that line, you know, I can't recall, you know, what's still on either end of it. But the idea is that in the places that I know best in the United States, you know, which at this point now, right, would be like Atlanta and Baltimore, Black Americans who have a similar background to my own are fairly reluctant to move into neighborhoods like these historic neighborhoods, you know, that are created right at the moment of the formal, well, it's their informal racial covenants, but it's sort of like the first emergence of formal American segregation. Prior to the codification of American habitational segregation patterns through the Federal Housing Authority and the New Deal program and projects. So in other words, that's in the 1930s that creates, you know, pretty much the America of today. But the turn of the century, 19th to the 20th century America, is becoming formally segregated in a private way, is maybe the best way to sort of phrase it. So for whatever reason, you know, I'm drawn to these, Frederick Law Olmsted Company landscape parts of the U.S., right? You have them in Baltimore, in Atlanta, in St. Louis. You know, it really is, you know, sort of a ubiquitous design where you have, you know, sort of a large central park, and then you have these parkland neighborhoods, usually somewhat adjacent or, you know, not too far from the central park. I mean, the one in Atlanta on Ponce de Leon is, you know, I think it's quite beautiful, right? I mean, to this day. But for whatever reason, Black Americans aren't necessarily drawn to the sacrifice required to live in these neighborhoods. You might be updating old houses. You might be paying, you know, top of the market price for, you know, a place that doesn't have so many bedrooms or bathrooms. You know, many of the amenities that are connected to these neighborhoods are cultural and aesthetic, very maybe much less so practical, and you know, offering, you know, sort of a immediate result or consequence, and so, you know, that would be like the structural side of it. But then the social side of it, of course, is that you're moving into neighborhoods that have, you know, legacy homeowners and also have residents, you know, who would like to see the neighborhoods continue as they have been in the past. And I have found it fascinating that even though many of the neighborhoods are located sort of centrally in the cities, which, you know, enables ease of access, at least to the downtowns, that they still have not sort of caught on with, you know, my generation of Black educated people. So that's part of the thing, I guess, that I am wondering if there is a kind of a tangible value in enjoying life in a neighborhood like Homeland. But then at the same time, it occurs to me that, you know, like, hey, is there something wrong with me? Like, where I'm really keen on the stone facade, or, you know, the dentilated cornice or something, or the slate roof or the copper gutter, that is like a part in a historic sense, a part of my fondness for bondage or servitude or something. You know, am I misunderstanding something? I'm the person who's like, no, we shouldn't run away. Let's stay on the old farm. Or, you know, Booker T. Washington always said that, you know, you wanted to, even after emancipation, you wanted to leave for a little while. And then before you came back, to show that you were really free. And as you know, am I the person who's like, who can't get away from these places that are absolutely embedded in the legacy of segregation? And then, as I show in the book, I mean, it's also chattel slavery. I mean, you know, this wasn't like where I live today wasn't like a huge plantation. They actually didn't have so much of a plantation system this far north in Maryland. But enslaved people lived here and maybe buried not far away. And so, you know, it's just sort of puzzling through that contradiction, I suppose. You know, like I say, irony, contradiction, and paradox are rife in this work. But what does it say about the homeowner? What does it say about me as a person who desires some of the aspects of American middle class, upper middle class life? And is that also some sign of being, you know, sort of unfit for something that, you know, potentially could be much richer and much deeper in terms of its opportunities for human sociality? And that is that's another place of wrestling for me. You know, am I the person who also is short-sighted and chooses structure over the, again, I mentioned the density of human relationships? And I would love to say that, oh, you know, I'm always the person who is like, you know, I'm a great proponent, the vigorous proponent of humanity. But then sometimes I think I enjoy as much the clean, well-lighted place.
Yeah, that's interesting, the idea of the clean, well-lighted place, because I was thinking about the title, which is very deliberate, I assume, called Shelter, and it's not called Home. And I was curious about, for you, the difference between shelter and home. And I was thinking that because you talk about your sons and your custody with them, and you end up with custody of one, and one of them comes to visit you. But I was wondering if, as a father who can't live with both of his sons, if that affects your idea of home, because home may be beyond the building. Those were just some of the things that I was thinking about. So I wanted to ask you about what home meant and your title.
Yeah, that's like the most poignant question I think anybody's asked me connected to the project. I suppose the good news for me, and I think for my youngest son, is that he's going to come to Baltimore for high school. So at the end of the summer, which is pretty terrific. But I think that you have lodged on a distinction that's significant. And, you know, again, in my wrestling with the pursuit of a particular kind of inviolable middle class, it's like a plateau, I suppose, more so than a pedestal, an inviolable plateau of middle class standing. Instead of, and this is back to the contrast between, you know, the social and the structural, instead of, you know, getting a home, what you have is gussied shelter. The reason, the structural reason for buying the house, and I talk about this in the first chapter, you know, is that we're also at a place where, you know, we're just making these snap and often lockstep economic decisions. And the idea is, you know, not so much, you know, or you don't have enough time to think, is this the place for my life? It's always, you know, is this the place that I can resell at a moment's notice or that will be attractive enough to the market that, you know, it will make financial sense? And giving ourselves over to this logic is, you know, one of the places of strife in the work. The opening epigraph is from the first African-American elected to the Baltimore City Council, and he uses the term shelter. And, you know, Harry Cummings is saying, you know, around 1911, as this problem, Baltimore is the first place to create where the city council tried to segregate the city by block by block. And they exported it throughout the South, but it was not it did not withstand judicial scrutiny. However, it created a series of customs that were then, you know, sort of carried out or wound up being somewhat effective. But that, you know, this early African-American elected official thought that the key way to produce the outcome of national belonging, American citizenship, full citizenship rights, you know, was purchase a home, pay your taxes, you know, do the things that the other citizens are doing, and you know, you will bear the fruits of legal protections. You know, I mean, essentially. But at the same time, you know, it's fascinating that Cummings, who you know, was like moving Black families onto blocks where, you know, basically they were going to have, you know, rocks thrown through the windows and fires set outside and where it wouldn't be safe, you know, to enjoy your home, that it was also, you know, sort of right on this, right at this crossroads between, you know, sort of the home and then just the practical structure of the shelter that was the engine of the economic markets. And in that way too, you know, for me, you know, you can see sort of this wrestling with all of these Protestant figures, you know, sort of it's like in Pilgrim's Progress, and, you know, you sort of have the pilgrim with their shelter at the rear and the Bible under arm. And it's sort of like, you know, the wrath of God is coming down upon them. And, you know, also in other of the English writings, you know, sort of from the 17th century and 18th century that I've studied in school, but, you know, sort of never noticed. So some of the more interesting themes or the ones that would become relevant to me, especially later. So yeah, that's the book is also, I suppose, attempting to think about what does it mean to have a home, and, you know, what is necessary to achieve that. The thing that I wind up centering on the most, you know, has to do with this concept of the maintenance that's required, and it's the maintenance that turns maybe to. Turn the phrase, the maintenance that turns the shelter into the home is one that is seasonal and and enduring. And, you know, you don't get that, you don't get to the next place without the steady maintenance, without the commitment, without the participation.
So where is the balance for you when you write between emotion and fact?
The balance for me is toward fact. I'm not sure why that is. Yeah, it's it is toward fact. The that place probably slips when I try to rely on memory, which is less stable, or it has played me false, I suppose. But yeah, for me, I am intrigued by what I'm able to, you know, sort of get my hands on that I would, you know, think of as the historical record. And you work on those features. I talk about woodworking in the book, and the, you know, as you sort of go through the different stages, I'm always at the early apprentice stage as a woodworker or carpenter. I can't call myself a carpenter at all, but anyway, just as a woodworker. But anyway, you learn ultimately the value of the sand, paper, and sanding. And I would say if the nugget of fact in my in this project, you know, is constantly being refined with the sanding of emotion, it maybe works that way.
My last question before I get to the final ones has to do with what you want people to get out of this book if they pick it up. What do you hope they walk away with?
I someone has asked me that before, and I have actually thought about this one a little bit differently now. Yeah, it would be fantastic if someone would read Shelter. Let me start again. After a reading a few days ago, a woman came up to me, an Episcopalian, a white woman Episcopalian, and she said, you know, I had been involved with the Diocesan Reconciliation and Reparation Committee, and it was an important journey for me because she said she was from a slaveholding family or family that enslaved people. And she mentioned a couple of the things that I talked about with the book and the neighborhood of Homeland, which was called Job's Addition in the early 1700s, as, you know, an enabling a fuller recognition of the nature of her own historical experience, but also the connections to people far and wide, but maybe especially to Black people in this metropolitan area. Another person asked me, "What were the did I think that the names of prominent historic Marylanders, and the most prominent would be Carroll, if they, if the African Americans who had been enslaved by the Carroll family or families like the Carrolls had continued to use their names, and were there in contemporary times, you know, actually two branches, a Black branch and a white branch of these Revolutionary era or, you know, colonial Maryland era families." And so I hope that the book actually does a bit of that, that people read the book, and which, you know, only has a little bit on the antebellum history side and a lot more on, you know, sort of the contemporary Baltimore and some dimensions of Baltimore inner workings in politics. But I would hope that they would understand that rather than Black Americans who still comprise the majority of the city is shrinking every year, but rather than Black Americans as being, you know, sort of like either completely distant, foreign, or unknown, that these are actually family members, and that the divisions and the lines across the racial lines, across the racial divide, which is, you know, as significant here in the city and in the county as anywhere in the United States, that they are most artificial, and that in the same way that one bears responsibility and an obligation towards one's family member, that we bear an obligation and a responsibility for the totality of the region. And, you know, if we dislike the you know, pick your poison, right? If we dislike the state of crime in Baltimore, that's always the thing that's pointed to as the thing that is dissolving the social fabric, the thing that's destroying the possibility for investment, the thing that is making public education unstable. But, you know, if we want to change, you know, sort of any single dimension of contemporary experience, that we have to take upon us the necessity of these family obligations. I think that it's sort of a great game that's played much of the time, where, you know, people from the suburbs or maybe the more affluent sections of the city will sort of drive through the city on their way to the stadiums or the waterfront, and, you know, sort of can easily bypass less affluent members of the community, and then sometimes members of the community who are actively experiencing extraordinary trauma, and think of them as being, you know, sort of these people from, you know, like another world. But that is that's an extreme illusion. We are not very far generationally removed from, you know, the time when white Americans lived on the large boulevards and Black Americans lived on the alley streets perpendicular to the boulevards, or, you know, sort of adjacent or in the rear, and worked in the homes, and where there was certainly a hierarchical oppression within that social community, but nonetheless where people had another sense of what the relationships were and the places of belonging. And I think that some of that sense of connectedness needs to resume for a more thoroughgoing and democratic transformation to take place. So the book is a plea for a rejuvenated city, a better city. And I talk about this, I think this is in chapter 5, where, you know, like I created it's a free jazz concert in the center of the Black West Side, to, you know, sort of give people an opportunity to get to know their neighbors.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
I can. After our conversation now, I do sort of wish that I had maybe chosen one that was like a little bit different, because I feel like I've been sounding like super professorial. And this is going to, you know, it won't disabuse people of that notion, but, you know, nonetheless, right, this is what I prepared. This is the first thing that came to mind when you asked that question. So I think that the most important unread novel is Chester Himes' Lonely Crusade. And I think that in the work of Chester Himes, all of the questions, all of the things that are exciting to us in the contemporary moment, found their way into print between 1945 and 1960. And I think that that's another part of the historical recovery that we need to have underway, is that we need to pay closer attention to what the record already makes available to us. So this is a passage from the novel Lonely Crusade. The hero's name is Lee Gordon. He's a college graduate from California, being groomed as a union organizer, but he's uncertain about the position because the difficulties of communicating with his supervisors And it's also important to remember that his father was shot and killed by the police in a case of mistaken identity. Now, Lee was in the position of either having to explain what was nearly unexplainable or appearing a consummate fool. It had taken him some time to realize the scope of the Negro workers' attitude toward unionism. At once, it was a curious mixture of logical antipathy and great expectation. For while their cold racial logic told them that the union was also another racial barrier, their deep yearning for democracy caused them to expect from it not only the opportunity for full-fledged participation, but in addition, special consideration and privileges. They did not want to be just members. They wanted to be special members with rights and privileges above all other members. This had been hard enough for Lee to understand, and now before opening his mouth, he realized the futility of hoping that Smitty could. The thought processes of Smitty would not be the same as those of any Negro. They'd been planted in a different soil and cultivated differently. And Lee knew this, but he attempted the explanation because it was congesting within him and had to come out. First, he argued that no more discrimination existed than in the plant than there would be after it had been organized, that the lack of Negro lead men and foremen, both before and after organization, would be attributed to seniority. By seniority, white workers would be promoted to higher paid jobs and Negroes employed to fill the lower paid ones. And what had the union to offer that would relieve this? Nothing. For the basis of unionism was also seniority, which seemed right and just. The union would always press for the establishment of the rigid rule that the first to be hired should be the last to be fired, and that promotions to higher ratings should also be based on length of service. But Negro workers read it the other way. Lee doggedly insisted that the last to be hired would be the first to be fired, and they would always be the last to be hired, first because of prejudice, and second because of their lack of experience. For how could a man get experience at a trade without ever having had a chance to work at it? Under the company merit system, Negroes could at least hope that by application and hard work, superior acumen, and Uncle Tomming, that they might get a better job than they would by the process of seniority. They would accept discrimination because without unionism, they would expect discrimination. Lee Gordon struggled earnestly to explain the Negro workers' attitude toward discrimination, the fact that discrimination had become a way of life. They had accepted it as part of the role they lived, as a condition of existence, beginning with the ability to think and never ending. They had resigned themselves to expect no better.
Do you want to say anything else about that?
Well, I as a child, I would always ask my dad, my God, how could you accept segregation or discrimination? You know, what's wrong with you? Why didn't you rise up? Become an expatriate, lead the rebellion, be the martyr, sacrifice yourself, commit violent acts, right? And of course, the nature of Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, right? The nature of violent acts committed by African Americans is always understood completely beyond any political context, right? These are just the criminal acts of individuals. It's always presented that way, right? But there's another context for the nature of violent acts among African Americans or in the American national political scene. And, again, for me, Himes had the in a very specific, particular, and deliberate way, acknowledged the blend of contradictions that gave the dilemma of the black worker attempting to overcome the condition of, the expectation of discrimination and discrimination as a feature of American life. I had a conversation with someone that is a coworker at the main private employer in the state of Maryland. And, this person who is working in another branch of the university than I am is describing specifically the way that Black Americans are actively and aggressively discouraged from pursuing higher work ratings or workmen's training, workmen and women's training, capacity. I mean, that's the nature of our society and system right now. So, you know, that's why I always say that people should return to Chester Himes, or, you know, he made a huge investment in trying to get it on the page early on.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft.
This is from the chapter Epiphany Boys. This is from the chapter Epiphany, Sunday Boys. My Toft and Croft and homeland has obliged me to drive other roads to church. Now my Sunday morning duty to defend the faith of England, Scotland, Ireland, and France, as the Maryland property ledgers from the 17th century used to remind the pilgrim, takes me down the Jones Falls Expressway to exit at Mount Royal and North Avenue. The western skyline of the intersection is dominated by the Maryland Institute College of Art dormitories. The field where we had run riot so many years ago hosts a four-story MICA housing complex. Recess at my old elementary middle school has become a tepid, corralled affair. The traffic pattern is restrained too. The city has installed a bike lane on North Avenue traveling west for the people who do not live here quite yet, but it wishes to attract. If we catch a crowded light and a boy comes to the window with a squeegee in his hand, I decline the windshield wash and press dollars and coins into his palm. There is a debate over whether or not the guys are entrepreneurs or villains, but I admire the gritty boys hustling and working together inside their age group. They are at least momentarily declining the vigorous exploitation of the drug corners. My dad's voice comes back to me about the intrinsic value of venture work that he called hustling. Critics of the squeegee boys, a venerable occupation since the 1980s, have long remained hypocritically silent as truant children in desperate need of minimal education relay narcotics and dodge maniacs and bullets. Their loud objections come when poor boys and girls make themselves obstreperous in public, trying to improve their condition by legal means. Baltimoreans of today rarely recall that George Herman Ruth was such a boy. Nor do we wish to face the reality that our city can easily contain the living conditions of the first, second, and third worlds, or the seemingly incompatible epochs of feudalism and capitalism in a single space. I tuck change and small bills into the compartments of the car for them and go out of my way to palaver encouragingly. I can be as fearful of strangers as the next person, but with just a little verbal courtesy, even when my purse is empty, the Sunday boys strike me as somber and reflective, adept at some Bible verse, eager to share a prayer.
And do you want to share why you chose that?
The book has gone through quite a bit of revision, and some of the sections, you know, it was like trying to juggle these blocks or building stones into place. And one of the struggles that I have as a writer, you know, it does have to do with like my own sense of humor, which is the thing that I indulge the most. And then also my own particular sense of history. And so I often can forget, or it's easy for me to forget, that I don't have the same comedic or historic assumptions in place or in a shared place with, you know, sort of a prospective audience. So I have to work myself to strike a good balance that way, or places where I have to restrain my sense of humor, and then also to try to ease in different places, different dimensions of the historical record. So when I started working with these property records, I was trying to figure out who owned the lot in Homeland, you know, and I'm like at the end of the 1600s, and I couldn't get over, you know, sort of the language and, you know, how closely connected private property, property acquisition, and what would make a title to property enduring in the minds of late 17th century Englishmen, you know, was absolutely connected to, you know, the propagation of the faith. And then the person who represented God on earth, the sovereign, the monarch. And I kept trying to figure out a way to get that dimension of leaving Homeland and going through Sandtown to the edge of Sandtown, Upton and Harlem Park, where my church is located. Sandtown is where we had our uprising in 2015 after the death of Freddie Gray. And it's the place where I have my annual concert. But just, you know, trying to tease the different elements and to condense them without improperly silencing the spirit or, you know, again, my own, let's call it my comedic virtue. That was the challenge there. And I was at work quite a while trying to strike the right balance. And also, I mean, this is the key thing for me, Mitzi, is that I am working as hard as I can to be honest. We have a controversy here because the guy who's running for governor became known to the public and, you know, was like on the Oprah Winfrey show because he wrote a book where he compares his trajectory to the trajectory of a person who was, you know, significantly less fortunate and who winds up being in prison for life. And, you know, today this person running for governor is being accused of like inauthenticity or, you know, sort of taking advantage of the misery of one person to, you know, sort of present himself to the public. And the main thing is he's accused of faking his connection to the city. And I always want to be incredibly accurate, you know, sort of about like, you know, the community that's produced me, where I live today, the way that I'm trying to raise the family that I have. But at the same time, the way that I see connectivity with so many other parts and places of the city and the people of the city. And I mean, I try to do that very deliberately in all of the chapters. And so in that opening to Epiphany Boys, I'm trying to pull a lot of it together. My, in one place or in two paragraphs, my schooling there in the 70s, the conditions of today, and the gentrification that is underway, or the hopeful gentrification is what it is actually from the point of view of the developers in the city.
Where do you write?
Back in the day, I used to write at an indie coffee shop wherever I could find one. That's always been my preference. Since COVID, I've been writing at the Cherrywood dining room table that I made with my son. And then sometimes I write in the sun porch where I can sort of look onto the azalea bush and the holly.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I try to rest. I close my eyes.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
So this is a snarky answer, but like the rapper Capadonna from the Wu-Tang Clan, I have a by myself meeting. Every evening I have a by myself meeting and I communicate with my inner Crystal Gallatin. And this is sort of an inside joke. That's a classmate of mine from 66 who then went on to become a classmate of my closest friend at Walbrook Senior High School. But when we were children, we were playing ball one day and I was playing ball with my friend, John Price, and Crystal hit me in the chest and knocked the wind out of me. Now I would say that probably happened more than one time. Not so much with Crystal, but just in elementary school, excuse me. But it was certainly memorable, and she followed it up with the inimitable idiom of Crystal Gallatin. She was a legendary primary and secondary school student.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Rejection is the major driver in my emotional life. It is my most faithful companion and my existential antidote, right? Rejection is the thing that prevents me from being suicidal in the existential schema. And it is the thing that I can count on.
And what is your favorite word?
My favorite word is juice, which is also my earliest word.
Thank you so much for your time and for this conversation. I'm deeply appreciative.
I really enjoyed it. It was great to get to know you. Thank you.
If you like today's show with Lawrence Jackson, author of the nonfiction book Shelter, check out my interview with Sejal Shah, author of the essay collection This Is One Way to Dance. We talked about the neighborhood she grew up in, invisibility and hypervisibility, and the experience of being read as a writer of color. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 360 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, books, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Zena Hashim Beck, Charles Baxter, Elizabeth Strout, and Lydia Yuknovich. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Merv Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.